Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. Today's program is titled Moving Music, and in it we are exploring music inspired by the art of dance. In part one, we went back into ancient history and showed the impact of dance on the music of the biblical record. And then we started our main discussion of the standard music repertoire. And as I said in part one, I'm not discussing this subject in our typical Baroque, classical, romantic, modern chronological order. Rather, I've broken these musical examples into four other main categories. We discussed the first three categories in part one, and these categories consisted of pieces that were intended to be listened to and not necessarily danced to. The first category was concert music inspired by a specific kind of dance or dance meter. The second was programmatic concert music meant to depict a scene or story with dancing in it, but not necessarily to be danced to itself. And the third category was vocal music, which contains text about dancing, which inspired the composers to give it a dance-like quality when they wrote the music. The fourth category is the most obvious grouping in our discussion of how the art of dance has impacted the musical repertoire, and that is music intended to be danced to in a staged production, either as a segment of an opera or play where the characters would dance, or a dance break would represent some element in the story, or as an entire production intended to be danced to, that is, a ballet. There is obviously so much material in this category, but I want to dwell on some of the most significant dance moments of operatic history and some of the greatest musical moments from ballet history. Before the break, we heard an example from Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel. It was a vocal example where the music had a dance-like quality because of the nature of the text, the sister trying to teach the brother how to dance. There's a more formal dance, though, later in the plot, a dance break where the siblings are sleeping in the forest. The angels that they have prayed would protect them dance in a ballet break, and it is a most beautiful moment musically in the opera. Here is the Staatskapelle Dresden's recording of this opera with Sir Colin Davis conducting. This is the Ballet of Angels from Hansel and Gretel. Thank you. That was the ballet at the end of Act Two of Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel, performed by Sir Colin Davis conducting the Staatskapelle Dresden. We are currently talking about music written into staged vocal productions that were intended to be danced to, dance breaks or ballet breaks, if you will. The music for ballets, I should mention here, grew out of the court dances and folk dances of the Renaissance and Baroque eras, some groundbreaking composers who entertained their royal patrons by using a plot to tie a series of these court dances and folk dances together. So oftentimes later in history, when a composer would write a dance break into a specific operatic production, the composer would base it on one of these foundational dances from which ballet originated. Mozart did this for the ballets within his operas. The ballroom scene at the end of the first act of Don Giovanni includes a minuet, a contradance, and a German dance. In The Marriage of Figaro, the love note passed from Susanna to Count Almaviva occurs during the ballet scene where they are dancing a fandango, a Spanish dance, which is fitting since the story is set in Spain. And if you ever saw the movie Amadeus from the 1980s, you couldn't forget the famous march used in The Marriage of Figaro as the wedding dance. This is the part of the story where the characters would actually have danced at the wedding, but those plotting for Mozart's demise took the music out of the scene since His Majesty Emperor Joseph II had forbidden ballet and operas. But when the emperor shows up unannounced for a rehearsal and sees the characters jumping around on stage to complete silence, he wonders what's wrong. When his aides tell him that this is what he has decreed, he says, "Well, look at them," and asks to put the music back in. And Figaro was premiered with the dancing that Mozart's score had intended. An interesting aside here is that Mozart personally loved dancing. A famous tenor of his day said, "As great as Mozart's genius was, he was an enthusiast in dancing and often said that his taste lay in that art rather than in music." In a letter to his father, the 21-year-old composer expressed his willingness to dance only with girls who could keep up with him. He wrote, "There was dancing, but I only danced 4 minuets, and by 11 I was back in my room. Because with all those girls there, there was only one who could dance in time with the beat." That's what Mozart wrote to his father. But what I want to play for you here is a movement from a substantial ballet scene at the end of Mozart's 1781 opera, Idomeneo, King of Crete. You could call it a dance break, but it was at the end of the entire opera, probably at the request of the Bavarian royal who commissioned the work. This is a movement from that big ballet at the end of the opera called the passepied movement. A passepied is a relatively quick triple-meter French court dance, and here it is performed by the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Christopher Hogwood.
Thank you.
So that was a passe-pied movement from Mozart's opera Idomeneo, and it was an example of a dance break within a larger staged vocal production, in this case, a large ballet section at the end of the opera. That was Christopher Hogwood conducting the Academy of Ancient Music. Returning back to the Romantic era, dance breaks, or a ballet movement or two, became extremely important to the success of an opera. Paris was the center of opera in this time period, and it was home to what we call the grand opera tradition, which usually featured elaborate sets, lots of special effects, and at least one major ballet scene. In fact, for an opera to truly succeed, it had to have a ballet scene. In Giuseppe Verdi's opera Aida, he incorporated a ballet for this purpose, but musically it has been criticized as sticking out and not fitting in with the victory march that surrounds it. Here's the famous processional scene where the characters are celebrating their military's victory over a neighboring nation. In this parade of spoils, it's quite obvious where the bombastic music changes into the light, airy ballet music to satisfy the Parisians. Here's a recording of the Rome Opera House Orchestra and Chorus under conductor Zubin Mehta. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. In today's episode, titled Moving Music, we are exploring the impact the art of dance has had on music history. That was the famous ballet scene from Verdi's opera Aida, which sticks out a little bit musically from the grandiose victory march music that surrounds it, but it was important to include a ballet in your opera in this time period if you wanted it to succeed. We heard the recording of the Rome Opera House Orchestra and Chorus under conductor Zubin Mehta. So we are currently exploring music intended to be danced to in a staged production. We were specifically focusing on great moments in opera where the characters would dance or there would be a dance break that would represent some element in the story. Now let's move into great musical moments in ballet history where the entire production was intended to be danced. The first one I want to play is more of a modern example of a dance production and one that was revolutionary in the world of ballet, thanks to the work of American choreographer Martha Graham. And in this case, the composer, Aaron Copland, didn't have any particular story in mind, nor did he have any specific dances in mind that Martha should use. He just wrote a 30-minute dance score, and she applied her own story and title to it. Copland had called it Ballet for Martha. Martha called it Appalachian Spring, based on a phrase from a section of a Hart Crane poem, The Dance. I've played the Simple Gifts theme and variations section in a previous episode. Let's listen to another lively portion of Appalachian Spring. Here it is performed by Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra.
Thank you.
That was a 1945 Pulitzer Prize-winning score by Aaron Copland, a composition of his that he titled Ballet for Martha. The American dancer and choreographer Martha Graham had asked Copland to write her a ballet. She was the one who applied the moniker Appalachian Spring, the title by which we know the piece today. Copland's new music, with its syncopations and its multi-meter treatment of rhythm, and its use of American-sounding folk tunes and musical concepts, plus Martha Graham's choreography, revolutionized the combination of dance and music. A Russian composer who was also an influential force in the art of dance was Igor Stravinsky. When the ballet impresario Sergei Diaghilev was gathering his country's best dancers, choreographers, and set designers, he went to Igor Stravinsky to be the composer for the new ballet company. The first major Diaghilev production for which Stravinsky composed was a well-known fairy tale known as The Firebird. I want to play you The Dance of the Firebird, the title character's dramatic entrance, full of dazzling leaps, which you can hear aptly matched by the music. This is a recording of Simon Rattle conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. That was Igor Stravinsky's Dance of the Firebird, composed for the ballet The Firebird, and we heard it performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, with Simon Rattle conducting. Another influential Russian composer who wrote ballet music was Sergei Prokofiev. His most well-known ballets are Cinderella and Romeo and Juliet. I want to play you one of the famous dance scenes from this ballet. This is The Dance of the Knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S, performed by Lorne Mazel and the Cleveland Orchestra.
Thank you.
So that was the Dance of the Knights, performed by Lauren Mazel and the Cleveland Orchestra. It was a segment of Sergei Prokofiev's ballet, Romeo and Juliet. In this portion of our show, we're talking about composers who wrote music specifically for dance productions, that is, ballets. We've talked about Copland, Stravinsky, and Prokofiev. But one of the most famous composers of ballet is Peter Tchaikovsky, who worked with the famed ballet master Marius Petipa. This choreographer-composer team produced three of the most famous ballets of all time, The Sleeping Beauty, Nutcracker, and Swan Lake. We're going to listen to a sample of Swan Lake here. In addition to a couple of waltzes in the score, this ballet incorporates several different types of traditional folk dances. In a scene where different girls from different parts of Europe are dancing, Tchaikovsky writes music for a Hungarian dance, a Spanish dance, an Italian dance, and a Polish dance. One of the most famous dance movements in this work, though, is the Dance of the Little Swans. Here it is performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra under Riccardo Muti. That was the Dance of the Little Swans, performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra and conductor Riccardo Muti. And we are exploring music composed for ballets at this portion of our program. Often certain pieces of music have such a dance-like quality to them, even if the composer didn't intend them to be danced to, dancers will take the music and stage dance productions to that music. This was the case with some of Peter Tchaikovsky's music, especially his Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture. Marius Petipa, that choreographer for whom Tchaikovsky wrote his ballets, choreographed this orchestral masterpiece into a commonly performed ballet. Let's hear some of this. So this is an example of transforming a piece of symphonic music into a dance production. I do want to mention also that this works the other way around, too. Aaron Copland, when commissioned to write a symphony, was having trouble meeting the deadline, according to his publishing company, Boosey & Hawkes. To finish the work, he took three dances from a ballet he'd written earlier in life and submitted them as a symphony in three movements, a symphony known as his Dance Symphony. But let's listen to some of this Tchaikovsky example. This is a portion of the Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture, a piece written for orchestra, but later turned into a famous ballet. And this is a recording of Daniele Gatti conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Moving Music, and in it we are exploring music inspired by the art of dance. We just heard some of Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, and this was a piece not originally intended to be a ballet, but the music was later choreographed as a ballet. Now let's show how the art of dance has even impacted music education. For that, we will get into our Classroom Corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. Physical movement and dance play a key role in the music classroom, particularly that of younger children. Music teachers know that incorporating physical movement in their classrooms develops the musical skills of a child more effectively than just the aural or oral training. Associating movement with sound develops a greater sense of the beat, rhythm, and meter. It also instills a greater understanding of musical phrasing. If an accented beat, for example, is associated with a pattern, as in pat, clap, clap, for strong, weak, weak, a student will more easily recognize the beat pattern. Movement helps students connect to what they are hearing in a deeper way and create stronger associations. Here at Imperial Academy of Edmond, in our general elementary music class, we use a variety of exercises to put motion with the more auditory concepts of pitch and rhythm. Sometimes we'll use a simple children's song like The Hokey Pokey, which combines kinesthetic, auditory, and visual learning and teaches the difference between right and left. And sometimes we'll use slightly more complex concepts, such as learning the basic conducting patterns of a 2-beat, 3-beat, or even 4-beat stress pattern. Marching to the beat also is an effective way to more deeply understand the idea of beat and tempo. And keep in mind that this is all happening with young students whose motor skills are still developing, so it's even aiding their growth in non-musical ways. An early 20th century music educator, Emile Jacques Dalcroze, helped popularize movement in music education. He stated that the first instrument that must be trained in music is the body. Another method of music education that was discussed in an earlier episode, the Kodai method, incorporates movement through games and performing on instruments, also through uses of hand signs associated with the solfège scale degrees. This aids in a child's musical and motor development early on. But even into higher grades, choral conductors, for instance, will commonly have their student choirs use a variety of movements to reinforce these same concepts. Whether it's walking around the room to the beat for an understanding of the general pulse in a rhythmically complex section, or whether it's snapping on the offbeats to make sure certain parts of the measure aren't cheated, or whether it's using a fluid arm motion to help achieve a better legato in specific phrases, the movement of the hands, the feet, or a combination of these can be a tremendous aid in learning music. This has been Classroom Corner. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Moving Music, and in it we are exploring music inspired by the art of dance. Finally, let's have our dessert for today, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the program, or sometimes just some lighter classical fare. I want to play the work of a 20th century Argentine composer, Astor Piazzolla. His work was influenced by the traditional tangos of his native land, the work of Johann Sebastian Bach, as well as the jazz of New York in the mid-20th century, where his family moved early in his life. This fusion of these influences created a whole new genre of music. It took what you might call the intellectual aspects of Baroque music, the improvisatory nature of jazz, and a traditional dance style from Argentina, and combined them into a style we now call Nuevo Tango. Despite the fact that this style wasn't initially accepted by the lovers of traditional tango, it is a great example of a specific dance style influencing a new kind of music composition. And so here was the art of dance and the spirit of dance impacting another great composer and musician. His most famous work, the Liber Tango, composed in 1974, is considered the pinnacle of this Nuevo Tango genre. It's a great example of how he infused classical and jazz styles into this traditional dance style. So enjoy from Yo-Yo Ma's album, Classic Yo-Yo, Astor Piazzolla's Liber Tango. You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.